Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. I'm really thrilled to have my guest Phil Hall, a movie historian, on today. We'll be discussing films, particularly the Bigfoot film. This is the iconic, famous Patterson-Gimlin film that you see him walking with swinging those arms and walking through the woods. I think it's about 50 years ago now. And this film really impacted me as a kid and many of you. It just kind of catalyzed this whole Bigfoot craze. And we're going to, the thing I love about Phil is not just the Bigfoot fascination, which many of us have, but as a person that loves film as I do, as a person who's acted in films as I have, kind of deconstructing this and looking at, the issues surrounding this film and the film itself. So after a brief identification of the show, we'll be right back with Film Hall, Bigfoot. Let's talk about that Bigfoot film. And, of course, you can, as you're listening, probably YouTube or Google it and watch the film itself, the Patterson Bigfoot film. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Back in 30 seconds.
Hey, Chief, there's two things in this world I hate to miss. One's a Lakers game and the other's Rich Rossi Live. You gotta be cuckoo to miss this show, you know what I mean, pal? And wait till you get a load of what Rich is gonna talk about today.
Well, we're gonna talk about today, as I said, the famous Bigfoot film with Phil Hall, author of a new book available through Amazon and all places where books are sold. And Phil has written a book about this film, and I believe it's called The Weirdest Movie Ever Made. Let me check that title. Yeah, The Weirdest Movie Ever Made by Phil Hall. And Phil, welcome to the show. You're on line one. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I sure can. I think we're both on landlines, which we may be the dinosaurs, the 45% that still has a landline, but it's sure better for radio than the cell phones that drop.
Hey, it works for me. Can't complain.
Well, I think we're probably pretty close in age. My mom said it's always rude to ask someone their age, but I'm 55, and I remember when this film hit, my late father took myself and my three brothers to see this with a kind of feature narrative wrapped around it, and they were, I think, four-walling around the country. And when I saw Bigfoot walk through the woods, I think it was only about a minute or so, but, oh, my God, I remember feeling so afraid and so this mystical, unidentified creature. And, there's certain things in childhood, I think, what impacts us emotionally, and for me it was like a fear and a wonder. The things that kind of impact that limbic system of the brain, and you feel something like you remember that. I, of course, don't remember everything, at 5 or 6 years old or whatever, but I remember this as clear as day, seeing this Patterson film for the first time as a kid. What was your first encounter with the film?
Well, to answer your first question, I am 54, so I'm a little bit younger than you. But my first encounter, to be honest, I can't remember because I didn't get to see the film in question that you saw, which was something called Bigfoot, America's Abominable Snowman, which was actually a mashup of a film that part of it was shot by Roger Patterson, and actually part of it was a BBC documentary, which is part of the film's convoluted history. I always remembered Bigfoot just being there. Back in the 1970s when I was a little kid, you couldn't turn on the TV or open a magazine or even go to the movies without some sort of wild stuff going on with Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and the Bermuda Triangle and UFOs. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun. It was sort of an alternative science, and as a kid, who doesn't love monsters and spaceships and whatnot? To me, Bigfoot was just always part of pop culture. And when I was writing this book, one of the things that dawned on me is just, wait a minute, Bigfoot wasn't always part of pop culture. There had to be a time when Bigfoot actually first, pardon the expression, set foot onto the national scene. And I was trying to figure out in my research, at what point did people start to realize that there might be something out in the woods walking about? And the book came about as both a cinematic appreciation of the 59 seconds of footage that Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin shot, as well as the film's impact on the cinematic culture, as well as the wider popular culture.
Mm. Yeah, your voice in the book and the way you tell his story is so great. And you start with a verse from the Psalms: one day tells tale to another, one night imparts knowledge to another, although they have no words or language, their voices are not heard. And there was something about this film that had a voice, that had that imparted something to us, and it just had such impact. You know, for me, I think the shaky camera stuff, I think, you know, initially it's like he's maybe on a horse and trying to steady the camera. I think if it would have been more perfectly executed, it might not have felt as scary to me as a kid, because it was obviously not a conventional, you know, it almost had that feel of reality TV or something at a time when everything, you know, was shot, all the TV shows were shot with bright lights so they could shoot stuff quickly and, you know, in tripods and everything. And there's the shakiness, and then you find the camera finally steadies and you see Bigfoot walking across. I mean, just aesthetically, it was very impactful for me.
And also, you could also look at it as being the other side of the cinematic coin from the 60s that included the Zapruder film, The Kennedy Assassination, which is a similar film in that it was not shot in 35mm. Zapruder worked in 8mm. Patterson and Gimlin had a 16mm camera. It was a grainy color. It wasn't perfectly framed. And yet you're seeing something that you shouldn't be seeing. And the fact that Zapruder, as just an observer to a presidential motorcade, and Patterson and Gimlin, who were not filmmakers, they were actually ex-rodeo riders who were on this cockamamie chase for something that may or may not have existed, managed to have their cameras in hand at the right time, basically created films that are still being dissected today, more than a half century after they were shot. The difference, of course, is that it's rather obvious that President Kennedy was killed, as captured on the Zapruder film, as well as two other lesser-known black-and-white films that were shot at in Dallas at the time. But we're still debating whether or not the creature in the Patterson-Gimlin film is real or whether it's a man in a suit.
Yeah, yeah, and there's people who would say, oh, what a coincidence, they go up there to film Bigfoot, and he just happens to be there. And then the gentleman that, I think he's still alive, the guy that claims he was in the suit, and he claims his relatives verify that, you know, they saw him with this suit at the time. What's your take on that whole debate?
That's Mr. Hieronymus, who was an acquaintance of Patterson and Gimlin. It's an interesting accusation. There are a couple of problems with it. One, there is no physical evidence putting him in Northern California the day that this film was supposedly shot. People in the area did see Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin about in the area, so their presence there has been confirmed. Mr. Hieronymus has not been confirmed. There's no photograph of him in the suit, and the suit itself has never been found. Now, there was a fellow out of North Carolina named Philip Morris, who has nothing to do with the cigarette company, and he ran a costume company, and he claimed that he sold the suit to Roger Patterson, but there's no paperwork, no receipt proving this. And the suit that's used in the film is not the type of suit that Philip Morris would have sold. You mentioned Bigfoot being a he. A lot of people don't realize this, but the Sasquatch in the film is supposedly a female. And if you look carefully, it has long floppy breasts that are covered in fur. And some people refer to it by the name Patty, which I think is a little too cute. But it's not supposed to be a male. It's supposed to be a female Sasquatch. But funny thing is, over time, people just assumed Bigfoot was a he, and when Hollywood started making Bigfoot movies and TV shows, Bigfoot got a sex change, and almost every Bigfoot film you see has a male Sasquatch, not a female.
Mm. Yeah, I read his accusations that he wore, he claims he wore football shoulder pads under the suit for the bigger shoulders and things, and then there's this footage of I said Hieronymus, you know, doing the arm swing thing. But, I mean, yeah, he can match the arm swing with the walk, but, I mean, I could do that or you could do that, just mimicking that, so it doesn't prove his case necessarily. But I felt real disappointed when I heard him at first. It was the feeling I had of when I was 8, and the kids at my St. Athanasius grade school in Pittsburgh said, "You're the only one baby enough to still believe in Santa. We all know it's our parents." And I just remember, like, the horror of someone telling me this is fake because, you know, I want to believe in Bigfoot, you know, and then this guy comes out and says, "Oh, no, no, I was in the suit. I'm telling the truth now after all these years." I mean, what do you think if he's lying? Is his, I mean, only God knows his motivation. Do you think it was 15 minutes of fame, or was he paid to, you know, to make this claim?
I'm not going to try to get into Mr. Hieronymus's mind because I don't know why he would say such a thing, especially if he doesn't have any documentary evidence backing it up. But wanting to believe in Bigfoot is not unusual for an 8-year-old or an 80-year-old. The book includes a couple of quotes from Jane Goodall, who is arguably the most famous anthropologist in the world. And she said that she is hopeful that there can be evidence that Bigfoot does exist. She said she wants to believe in it. She's aware of the history of the Sasquatch through Native American folklore. And somebody of her stature wants to believe in it and is not willing to dismiss it as being a man in a suit. Then maybe the story deserves a little extra attention.
Yeah, yeah, and she's just such a wonderful person, has done such great work in this field. You know, another argument I'm sure you've heard is, you know, how can we never find a corpse or whatever? But then, you know, I guess the counter is that animals in the forest, you know, devour one another once there's a corpse. And, you know, I mean, I guess the big thing is, why doesn't someone, you know, get a body or shoot one? Of course, I wouldn't want them to be shot. A fellow I had on the show a while back who hunted for Bigfoot said he believes it's a, I don't know if missing link's the word, but that if, you know, it's somewhat close to a very intelligent species like a human, that, you know, it'd be wrong to shoot it just to get the proof.
Well, there have been so many theories as to just what the creature would be. A possible theory could be it would be an offshoot of an extinct Asian primate called the Gigantopithecus, which could have easily come over to North America during the period in the Ice Age when Asia and North America was linked over the Bering Sea. But with Gigantopithecus, too, I mean, there's a bit of a mystery because the only thing we know about this creature is just some teeth and a fragment of a jawbone. We've never actually found the entire skeleton. And scientists have tried to theorize what it could have looked like, but that's just intelligent guessing because without having the actual skeleton, we don't know what it could have looked like. It could have just been a very small ape with an unusually large head. So you could just play endlessly as what is, what if. And that's the same thing with the Sasquatch. We don't know if it was a primate, if it was a missing link. Who knows? I mean, apparently when Leif Erikson came over to North America, in his expedition, he said that there were some creatures on the shoreline. He referred to them as foul, hairy creatures that were screaming at the boats that were approaching. Were these Sasquatches or were these Native Americans dressed in bear suits? We have no clue.
Another fascinating part for me, too, and my bias as an independent filmmaker about to release a film next year we're making called Canaanland, is just the distribution of this is really fascinating to me, the whole four-walling way that it got out. You write quite a bit about just, you have a whole chapter devoted to the cinematic parts of this getting out there. And I remember another film around the time from a friend of mine who's now past Tom Laughlin, Billy Jack, where he did a similar four-walling thing and it just blew up as kind of an indie film phenomenon. But how did they, with this footage, then get it to where it became such a pop culture thing? You know, and keeping in mind, of course, they didn't have online and social media and streaming on the Internet, and yet they somehow were able to get this thing a lot of attention. I think you write that it might have started in the Britain, but how did this get out there?
Well, the British aspect of the film that you're referring to, which is called Bigfoot, America's Abominable Snowman, apparently, the BBC wanted to show the footage on British TV, but they were a low-budget operation at the time, and they couldn't afford the licensing fee that Roger Patterson was demanding. So Patterson and the BBC came to an agreement. They would give him a copy of their documentary, which I think assume was a short film, that included the famous 59 seconds of footage. He could show it theatrically in the U.S., but it could not be broadcast on American TV, which was just as well because Roger Patterson didn't have any connections to American TV networks. So he shot new footage to wrap around this BBC short, and he took this on a platform release, which means you're going from city to city, town by town. And he was actually very shrewd about this. He went to a lot of smaller towns, first in the Pacific Northwest, then moving into the Midwest. They would be showing these films over a weekend. If there were no theaters in town, they would rent out a high school auditorium or a VFW hall. This was a 16-millimeter film, so it was easy to bring a projector with them. And they were just heavily promoted in local newspapers, whatever local radio stations would be there. And this was rather unusual because instead of having the usual Hollywood movie playing in town, all of a sudden there's this new independent film about some monster that people may or may not have heard about that's living on the West Coast. And Patterson made appearances at each screening telling about how he encountered Bigfoot. So for many of these small towns, this was really a big event. And
yes,
they were able to do this for roughly 2 years, and they made a whole lot of money. In fact, Al Jaitley, who was Roger Patterson's brother-in-law, was quoted as saying at one point they just had a trash can full of money from their box office receipts.
Yeah. Well, they had quite a few dollar bills for my dad and I and my three brothers and a bunch of neighborhood kids. and then it was, I love it. I just love this whole thing of the live event they created with the film. You know, we're at a time where, you know, there's hundreds of ways to get a film out there and everyone just throws it up on Amazon or iTunes or whatever. But I love this, the fact it was this interactive kind of tour, almost like a band touring. They went around the country for 2 years.
Yeah, it's an event. They don't have that in movies anymore. I mean, the big Hollywood blockbusters used to have what they called roadshow presentations.
Yeah.
Where it would be in one theater, usually in a major city. It would be reserved seating. They would have special programs to go with the screening. And it was an event. And you don't have events anymore in movies. Films are dumped into theaters, usually 1,000 theaters or more at a time. They play for 2-3 weeks, and then the following month you can find it on DVD or Blu-ray.
Yeah, and it just seems they go in the megaplex, these you know, $100 million hardware movies, and they're forgotten pretty quick, whereas this film and this footage, you know, as you mentioned, has had just a resonance where it just doesn't die. We keep talking about it. And, of course, as baby boomers, I remember and was so excited when Bigfoot made his appearance on one of my brothers and I's favorite shows as a kid, Bigfoot and Bionic Woman. And, of course, I had a crush like many boys on Lindsay Wagner, who's come on this show. In fact, she came on her birthday, and I got to serenade her and play Happy Birthday on the show on my guitar to her. That was something. I mean, kids today might think it's a little cheesy, but when I was 10 years old, to have Steve Austin, Jamie Summers, and Bigfoot on the same show, I mean, I might as well have died and went to heaven.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny, too, because back then, this was ABC, had the $6 Million Man and the Bionic Woman. It was a much different media landscape. So if you didn't watch the $6 Million Man, then you probably watch what was on CBS or NBC or maybe
right.
a local independent station. And that was about it, whatever PBS had as well. And that was it. And so it was a very limited choice. And the fact that programming in this limited media environment included Bigfoot shows says something about the popularity of the concept of Bigfoot. And this was something people wanted to see.
A very astute point. In fact, it's kind of funny. Last night at a gathering, I was talking with a director who's been around and directed a lot of great stuff, Jeremy Kagan, and we were talking about the fact that it's just not the same now with all these hundreds of options of stations through cable and internet streaming and Netflix as the kind of impact something would have back then. And my son, who's in his late 20s, has a rock band, and we were talking about marketing art, and we were talking about the cultural impact that his generation might probably never quite feel the way we did when you only had three main stations and you know, like when we were kids, like David Cassidy, Partridge Family, and we're all watching it Friday night and hearing the song and then talking about it at school the next day. Or I remember Wizard of Oz would always play, I think maybe Thanksgiving time, and we'd all us kids would be on the living room floor with all the neighbor kids and talking about it the next day. And Bigfoot had that kind of feeling to it when this all came out. We were just all talking about it in a way that if it was just one of 600 things we could watch, it might not quite have had the same type of landscape, like you said.
And there was also believability about it, too, because you have to realize from the TV shows like $6 Million Man or Bionic Woman, or programs like the Leonard Nimoy Show In Search Of,
yes,
that was on as well, and there was also a kid show, Bigfoot and Wild Boy. Sid and Marty Krofft put that together.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And the dozens of Bigfoot films and inspired films like Legend of Boggy Creek. One consistent thing about it is that people believed in Bigfoot. It was never like, oh, this is this stupid hoax that a couple of clowns put together. If something like that was done today, I think it would be widely rejected, because maybe we've just become so cynical and so demanding, and everybody is a critic and everybody knows everything. But in the 70s, it's like Bigfoot. It's like, oh, yeah, this makes perfect sense. Why not? We've never seen it except for the shaky film. Of course it has to be there. And so none of these productions from the 70s or going even into the 80s ever doubted it. They never said, oh, well, this is a fraud. And that's one of the reasons, I guess, why Bigfoot is still with us and we're still talking about it, is because it seemed to have always been accepted by the wider population and certainly by the entertainment industry.
Yeah, in fact, one of my dear friends who passed about a year ago now, Ron Howard's father, Rance Howard, who was in my film Sister Amy, and he was in a film, I think it was called Bigfoot Unforgettable Encounter, and a real fun film, about Bigfoot. And he had so much fun making that and talked to me about that. And it was just something that we all have kind of this good feeling about Bigfoot. You know, even though the film scared me, it's kind of a fond thing. It's like, it's almost like a demarcation of us baby boomers remembering the impact of this Patterson-Gimlin coming out, and as you say, the impact on popular culture. I mean, there's been other people shooting things and claiming photos since then, or putting up alleged footage since then, or alleged photos since then, but nothing seems to really touch this one. I mean, this is pretty much the film, isn't it?
It is. There have been other films which are rather obvious fakes, supposedly audio recordings, but it's hard to verify that because we don't really know what Bigfoot sounded like. The Patterson-Gimlin film is silent, so what the Sasquatch sounds like, I have no clue whatsoever, but that is the one. And even if you look at any Bigfoot-inspired artwork or graphic design, it always comes back to that famous frame from the Patterson-Gimlin film where Bigfoot turns around and has its arms swinging wide out. It's really become just an iconic moment in movie history, like Marilyn Monroe's skirt going up in The Seven-Year Itch, or Brando's Don Corleone sitting behind the desk stroking the cat. It's just something which is part of the cinema history. And that's why I wrote the book, because a lot of people within the film world don't see it that way. And I thought this was the one thing that needed to be brought forth. There are tons of books about Bigfoot, whether it's real, whether it's fake, but nobody looked at the Patterson-Gimlin film as cinema.
Yeah, and by the way, is Amazon where people best should get this book, The Weirdest Movie Ever Made, or do you have a website, or where do you prefer we direct people to?
Oh, you can look for it on Amazon. I think Barnes & Noble has it. My publisher is Bear Manna Media. They sell it from their website. If you have listeners in the UK, go to the W.H. Smith website. It can be sold over there as well.
Oh, great. Well, we'll take a brief break for show identification, and if you all have any questions, you can email them to richardrossilive@gmail.com, richardrossilive@gmail, or call the number on your screen. You can call in if you're listening online on most of your online systems. There you see a number right there, guest call in, or call in the show, 347 637 2379, and we can talk about your other most recent book about lost films that have been rediscovered. So we'll be right back with you, Phil, okay?
Okay.
We'll be right back and talk about some more great films that Phil has written about. Be back about 30 seconds. Don't go anywhere.
You search, you probe, your mind, your spirit becomes weary. You find yourself on a journey to find a talk show, not just an ordinary talk show, but a Christian talk show, unlike anything the mind could fathom. Suddenly, your search comes to an end, for up ahead, there's a signpost, your next stop, the Rich Rossi Live Zone.
Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live. We've been talking about a book entitled The Weirdest Movie Ever Made. Phil Hall has written this great book about the Bigfoot film. And if any of you want to email a question in, some are coming in, richardrossilive@gmail.com, or call 347-637-2379. Chris writes in, and he wants to know if anyone has tried to disprove the hoax theory. I guess we did touch on that. He might not have heard that, but about the gentleman that claims he's in the suit. I guess it's hard to prove a negative, but has anyone been able to disprove the hoax theory, or is it something that's hard to prove or disprove either way? It's you mentioned the lack of evidence earlier for the hoax theory.
Well, it's hard to prove and disprove. One of the problems is that we don't know what speed the film was shot on, because Roger Patterson was using a 16-millimeter camera that enabled him to shoot in both 24 frames per second, which is what's used for today's films, as well as the 16 frames per second, which was used in the silent movie era. This was a silent camera that he worked with, so that is why he was able to have that choice. But not knowing what it is that he shot it at makes it difficult to determine just how fast Bigfoot was really walking, and whether or not the arm swing was more exaggerated if it was being shot in slow motion as opposed to being shot in regular speed.
Mm. Another book, for all you listening, that's come out that Phil's written is about lost films. It's called In Search of Lost Films, Phil Hall. We were talking about, you and I earlier, Phil, off air, about the Orson Welles final film that was put together by some of his proteges, Peter Bogdanovich and others. Would that qualify, or is that more of an assembly of an incomplete work that wouldn't quite be a lost film? Or would that qualify, and if not, what would be the definition of a lost film that we refined?
Well, a lost film is a film, as its name suggests, is lost. It doesn't exist anymore. There are no prints, no negatives of the film. All we might have would be still photographs and press kits. Orson Welles' Other Side of the Wind wouldn't qualify because the film was never lost. It was basically tied up in legal issues for about four decades. The footage survived, obviously, because it's been assembled posthumously. But Welles made a film which I think might have been more interesting than The Other Side of the Wind, back in 1955, called Moby Dick Rehearsed, which was based on his stage play that was performed in London. And the film was about 75% finished when he ran out of money, and all of the footage from the film is considered lost. It was last seen in the late 60s. Somebody was shipping it, but they didn't want to pay the customs fee, so it was returned to the sender and then disappeared after that. So that's an example of a lost film.
Mm. There's something about these lost films and the bad films, as you've written about in the past, that is so fascinating to me. And I think part of it's as a filmmaker, an independent filmmaker, where I've had to kind of sometimes pull the rabbit out of the hat. You know, I'm really interested to see films that have had struggles. My wife sometimes chastises me, why do you watch that, the crappy Ed Wood films, But the fact he, you know, he makes these films against all odds, and then I think one of his was, I don't know if you could call it lost, I think it was tied up in a lab for, decades. I think it might have been The Bride of the Monster one, I'm not sure which one it was. I'm drawing a blank right now.
Bride of the Monster has been around for some years. There were a couple of Wood films.
Night of the Ghouls. I think it was
lost.
Night of the Ghouls.
Yeah, Night of the Ghouls is out, is available too, but some of his films from the 70s, Necromancy was considered lost for some years. I think it was rediscovered in a yard sale in the early 2000s. A couple of the adult films he made towards the end of his life are considered lost as well. So we have the best, or for Ed Wood's idea of the best of his films, but some of his lesser-known stuff has disappeared, unfortunately.
Well, when it's rediscovered at a garage sale, was it as a film reel or a VHS tape?
Yes, it was in a 16-millimeter film can.
Have any of these been found on when it's lost and refound in a way that's not the best, like instead of being like an actual reel, maybe a VHS tape or, a copy, and then you have to kind of just put out the best copy you have and kind of sell it even though it's not the best resolution?
Yes, there have been a lot of the silent films have been like that, where it's they were, some of them going way, way back to the turn of the 20th century, they were preserved on paper prints, and they had to be brought back onto celluloid, so there was a lot of degradation in the visual quality. There was actually a documentary made in 1941 called Kukan, which won the first Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. And that exists today only as a VHS copy. The original 35-millimeter copy had deteriorated so badly that it can't be preserved. Actually, the filmmaker Robin Long located it and brought it to the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, and they were unable to do anything with it because due to poor preservation, this last surviving print is unviewable.
Wow. This book, you get into all kind of, this is both the silent era, and you mentioned some of the old animation films that even predate Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. We've always kind of assumed that's the first feature-length animated film, but I think you mentioned in your book that there was actually prior animation films that beat him, but just we may not have it all.
Oh, yes. Actually, the beginning of motion picture animation at a feature-length presentation began in Argentina in 1917 with a film called The Apostle, and prints of that disappeared a very long time ago. Actually, the first animated sound film was also from Argentina, Petulopolis. It was a pun on one of the politicians of the era, and that disappeared as well, too. So the beginnings of animation are gone. Actually, a lot of breakthroughs in filmmaking don't exist. The first feature-length films from the late 1890s are gone. A lot of the early color films disappeared. The first experiments in 3D filmmaking have disappeared. The first widescreen films have disappeared. A lot of the early sound films disappeared. Many of them were actually intentionally destroyed. So, and it's not just the U.S., too. If you go to Europe, Asia, Africa, Latin America, a lot of the films that began the industries in those respective areas, those films are gone too.
Wow. Yeah, it's so amazing to think, like The Apostle you mentioned, 1917 or so, I think it was Snow White maybe in the 30s, so this is like, maybe at least 20 years before?
20 years, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and it didn't get played outside of Argentina because it was a parody of the nation's political scene. So there were only a finite number of prints that were made, and the last known material surviving of the film, I think it was destroyed in a fire in 1925. So the film only existed for about 8 years.
Wow. I know Scorsese, I had a friend working with him and others trying to kind of preserve films, and you know, there's a bunch of films they now have underground to try to help them not to degrade. The whole film preservation challenge is it's kind of been astounding to me to even hear of some of the great classic films where, you know, original prints have been endangered of being lost.
That's not unusual because up until fairly recently, maybe the 70s, there really wasn't a lot of thought given to film preservation, strangely enough. And they thought, well, archiving is good enough, but it isn't, because a lot of the old films, especially those made before 1950, were shot on nitrate film, and that's highly flammable if it's stored in too warm of a situation, and it also can deteriorate into goo if it's not stored in a cool enough situation. So people just took the old films and they would dump them in a warehouse. There have been a lot of warehouse fires over the years that destroyed many films. 20th Century Fox lost most of its silent films and a lot of its early sound films because of warehouse fire in 1937. And a lot of films also that had, it was assumed that these were just stored properly, they weren't. And when people went to open the can, they started to smell vinegar, and they saw that the films were warping and couldn't get through the projector.
Wow. Email question, Noel. She said she was scanning your writings and books that we had mentioned the bad films, and she wondered if what your guilty pleasures were as far as bad films, if you have some that, you know, that's so bad they're good variety that you personally like.
I also just want to point out, I goofed up the pronunciation of the first sound animated feature. It's called Plutopolis, and it's been a while since I've thought about that, but it's... Yeah, and it was basically, it was a parody about Pluto City in Argentina. It was a political satire from the early 1930s. People today probably would have no clue what it was about if they were watching it, at least in terms of a plot. But guilty pleasure films, oh, I got a lot of them. Many of them are actually more fun than the ones that I love. I'm a huge fan. I think I'm the only fan, maybe, of a film from 1951 called Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla. And that's the film starring the comedy team of Duke Mitchell
and
Sammy
Petrillo.
Well,
there's two of us, actually. Are those the guys that were the fake Martin and Lewis?
Yeah, they were Martin and Lewis.
Oh, I actually love that, too. There's two of us.
I actually screened this film. Years ago, I did a film series at the Siberia Bar in New York City, which sadly isn't around anymore. And I showed Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla. I got a full house, and people were laughing with the film. They weren't groaning. Nobody walked out. And at the end, they even applauded. It's one of these films. It's so utterly ridiculous. And as Martin and Lewis imitators, Mitchell and Petrillo weren't all that good. But the film, it's such a screwball mess that you can't help but love it. And I'm glad to hear that I'm not the only one who's fond of it.
Yeah, in fact, I think before he passed, Sammy Petrillo, talked about Lewis giving him a bit of a rough time about it.
Yeah, because Lewis thought that he was being ripped off, and they threatened him and the producers with lawsuit, which I don't think happened. The film made no impression when it came out, but over the years, it's gotten this. It's got a bad reputation. People don't think that Mitchell and Petrillo were funny, but if you watch the film, it is funny, and there's a lot of the movie which is genuinely funny. You're laughing at the film, you're laughing with it, and I enjoy the film. I'm glad to hear that you're a fan of it as well.
Yeah, in fact, it's kind of funny. I mentioned my wife's, gets a little tired of me, my enjoying bad movies. I mean, she'll watch them with me once and kind of laugh at them, but she's like, okay, that's something I don't want to see again. But she was actually impressed, as was I, with some moments of Petrillo's Jerry Lewis. It seemed like he actually was in the zone a few times with his channeling Jerry Lewis there.
Yeah, I mean, Petrillo was much better doing Jerry Lewis than Duke Mitchell was doing Dean Martin. Yeah,
we said that. We felt that, yeah. You mentioned The Wizard of Oz. Oh, you know what? I just realized we didn't fully answer. I apologize, Noella. She wanted to know a few guilty pleasures. Is it just that one, or is there any others you mentioned?
Oh, there are
so
others,
bad,
but I mean,
like.
I could. I don't want to monopolize the rest of the show. I know we have X number of minutes to fill, but I think if I had to pick one out of the bunch that I could watch over and over, that would be the one.
That would be the one. You mentioned in your book Lost Films, In Search of Lost Films. Is that the right title? Hopefully I got the title right.
Search of Lost Films.
Great book. You mentioned Wizard of Oz in there, which initially People would be shocked that you have a section on that. Could you explain that? And you mentioned Buddy Ebsen originally cast as Scarecrow, and
yeah.
Later switch. I love Buddy Ebsen and friends with his family, but it's hard now to imagine anyone other than Ray Bolger as the Scarecrow. But you mentioned that. Is that because some of the footage shot for that is gone?
Yes. That was part of the chapter on sequences from films that mm-hmm. disappeared, because a lot of films were much longer when they were produced and they were cut down, and a lot of historically important sequences have been jettisoned and lost. With The Wizard of Oz, I'm sure everybody who knows the story of the film's production knows that Buddy Ebsen was originally the Tin Man in the film. Actually, he was supposed to be the Scarecrow and Ray Bolger was supposed to be the Tin Man, and the two of them switched roles. Footage was shot. They began the production with Buddy Ebsen as the Tin Man. Dorothy also had a blonde wig. Judy Garland was not a blonde, so they made her look blonde because Dorothy in the Frank Baum books was supposed to be a little blonde girl. And Buddy Ebsen developed a severe allergic reaction to his makeup, and he was hospitalized. And his health had deteriorated so dramatically that they had to shut down the production. The part of the Tin Man was recast to Jack Haley. The original director, Richard Thorpe, was taken off the project. He was first replaced by George Cukor, who decided that Dorothy shouldn't be a blonde, so they got rid of the wig. Then George Cukor left because he was shooting Gone with the Wind, and they brought in Victor Fleming to direct the movie, which is interesting because Victor Fleming wound up replacing George Cukor on Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
Now, all of the footage that included Buddy Ebsen and that was shot by Richard Thorpe, including Dorothy as a blonde, doesn't exist anymore.
Wow.
And there's also a couple of musical numbers from the film that was shot by Victor Fleming, including the brunette Dorothy and Jack Haley, that were cut as well, the most famous being the Jitterbug number.
Yeah,
which was,
I've seen a few seconds of that.
Yeah, there's some home movie footage
DVD.
Of the production. The song exists, the recording still exists, the footage does not, and somebody brought an 8mm camera to the set, and so we have an idea of what it could have looked like from that. But there was also a reprise of Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, and if you watch the trailer to The Wizard of Oz, which you could find on YouTube, there's about 3 or 4 seconds from that sequence in the trailer, but the reprise was not used in the final film. In fact, one of the weird things about Wizard of Oz is that after Bert Lahr's song, If I Was King of the Forest, there's no music after that. All the songs disappear. What was also cut was supposed to be a reprise of Over the Rainbow, which Dorothy was supposed to sing in the Witch's Castle, and
wow.
That was filmed, but it wound up getting cut from the film.
Wow. It's astounding that that beautiful song. In fact, that was the first song I ever played myself, performed as a young boy on guitar, and I have a connection to it. My late father wrote out a beautiful jazz arrangement for me to play. He was jazz guitarist, so I have a real connection to that song. And then when I read that they were thinking of cutting that song out of the thing, it slows down the film. It's hard to believe now. Wow, we're running out of time, but just... I had to mention also, it was interesting to me, your book, you mentioned Mad, 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 Mad World, one of my wife and I's absolute favorite films, all those cameos. And we like it also because she grew up in Southern California. I did not. I grew up on the East Coast. But she likes it too because there's a lot of footage of how it looked when she was a girl in the 60s and, the Pikes Peak Amusement Park in Long Beach and just getting a feel for what it looked like back then. But you mentioned that in your book, some of that footage was also lost.
Oh, yes, because the original film ran 4 hours and 1 minute. That was Stanley Kramer's initial cut, and United Artists made him chop that out. I think he initially cut about 40 minutes out of the film, then he had to cut more of the film out. So the general release version, the one that you would see on television today and on most DVDs, is roughly 2.5 hours. So there is a lot of footage which is lost and a lot of star cameos, and also some of the actors who were in the film actually had bigger parts in the original
version. Yeah, I think you mentioned Don Knotts had a whole bit that was cut out, which is a shame.
Yeah.
I love Don Knotts.
And it would have made sense with his character, what happened, because if you remember in the film, Don Knotts is a motorist who picks up Phil Silvers. Right. And Phil Silvers bamboozles him into thinking that he's really a spy, and he's being chased by some enemies in a helicopter. It's actually the police surveillance. And they drive to a diner, and Phil Silvers commandeers him to get out of the car, go into the diner, and call for help. Phil Silvers drives off. We don't see Don Knotts go into the diner in the film. It just cuts to the next scene, and Don Knotts is not in the film anymore. As it was originally written and as it was shot, Don Knotts goes into a diner, and there's a line at a payphone. He starts pushing his way through to make a call to Washington because he's under the sincere belief that Phil Silvers was a spy. And it's there were several people, including Barbara Pepper, who you may remember from Green Acres, at the phone trying to fight him off while he's desperately trying to get ahead of everybody to make a phone call.
Mm. Oh, I would have loved to have seen that. One of the quotes that hit me, and thank you, Blog Talk Radio, for the grace. We're running over, so we might have lost some sections of the world, but at least the replay will have the next few moments, anyone that replays this. But you have an Orson Welles quote, "The enemy of art is the absence of limitations. The enemy of art is the absence of limitations." What do you think, what's that mean to you, or what do you think he meant by it?
The enemy of art is the absence of limitation. The absence of limitations is an interesting quote.
Yeah.
I would think that if you don't, I mean, art has to have a limit to itself. I mean, one of the problems with Welles was self-indulgence. And, I mean, you could spend your whole life working on a single film, but there has to be a time for it to be brought to a close. And film is not a one-person operation. It's a collaborative effort, too. And if you don't recognize the limits of your role in the filmmaking process, there's a problem.
Mm. What a quote. It really hit me when I saw that. I thank you so much, Phil. I love your books, and encourage you all to get Phil's books. He's actually written quite a few. We talked about two today, In Search of Lost Films and The Weirdest Movie Ever Made about the Bigfoot film. Is there another? Do you know what the next thing you feel
oh, yes.
passion to write about is?
The next one, and funny you mentioned passion, because the next movie book coming out in 2020 is going to be called Jesus Christ Movie Star, and it's going to be looking at how the cinema has portrayed Jesus from the 1890s to today's digital era.
Oh, wow. Well, please let us know. I'd love to promote that. I love Jesus. I don't always like what the church does. You know, my hometown had a big report there with the priests, you know, from Pennsylvania. And, in fact, my boyhood priest was in the report, now in jail. I have a joke where I said, growing up, they told me the church is the bride of Christ. And I always say, well, you know, I've always loved Jesus. I just don't always like his wife, you know, the things that people in religion do. But Jesus himself has been so great in cinema. And my son and I had the rare pleasure. We love the film Jesus Christ Superstar. Some of my fundamentalist Christian films, fundamentalist Christian friends are real angry at me that I like that film, and they say, well, that doesn't show the resurrection, and it shows Judas, you know, rising after Jesus. But to me, you know, even the sun going up, you know, the symbol at the end of that, I take that as, you know, he's still alive. But we love the music, and we got to see, for charity out here, they brought a lot of the original cast together, Ted Neely, Von Elliman, and there's a hall here called Ricardo Montalban Theater. And they had as many of the original cast. Of course, the guy that played Judas has passed, but they had Ben Vereen, who had done it on Broadway. And Jack Black was Herod, and they had a great live performance and raised money for a ministry to disadvantaged youth. And it was fantastic.
Wow, that's great. Well, actually, that year the movie came out, Jesus Christ Superstar, there were three Jesus musicals in theaters. There was that film,
yeah.
There was Godspell, and there was Johnny Cash's film, The Gospel Road.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Godspell, yeah, and Gospel Road. Yeah, Johnny Cash had a big conversion, spoke at the Billy Graham rallies and everything, and That's really something. I mean, I'm real fascinated. The film I got One Day Left Shooting is about religion. It's kind of a modern-day Alma Gantry-ish film. And I just think it's great. I'll look forward to that book. Yeah, it was kind of funny. There's a Golden Turkey Awards, and the worst Jesus film they put is Jesus Christ Superstar, but I disagree. I absolutely love Jesus Christ Superstar. I mean, I like the whole musical thing. I guess it's because I'm a kid of the 70s, and I remember going to see it. I was 10 years old. I think it was around 73. A couple guys, best buddies from school, we went and saw that thing, and it was just, again, it's almost like the Bigfoot thing. It was just something culturally, if you grew up at that time, it was really a big thing, and the whole hippie Jesus people movement was going on, you know, where millions of young people were saying, hey, we tried drugs, we tried sex, let's try Jesus. So it was a whole ethos that was going on.
That's right. Well, you know, it's really been a pleasure to be on your show, and when I have the new book ready, I'll certainly let you know.
Oh, we'll have to have you on. I'm now so excited about the new book. Do you have certain favorite Jesus films? I mean, there's a bunch of them on the top of my head. I mean, there's the Jesus of Nazareth and The Greatest Story Ever Told. I mean, there's so many. Do you have of course, Last Temptation of Christ, that'll be an interesting part if you get into that, the whole controversy over that film.
Well, I'm actually discovering and rediscovering a lot of the films, some which I saw many years ago, like Pasolini's film, The Gospel of St. Matthew. I want to take a second look at Cecil B. DeMille's King of Kings. I saw that many years ago, and I haven't seen that. And I just found the first British Jesus feature film, the Westminster Passion Play, Behold the Man. So that was a very interesting film. I've got a lot out there, so I don't want to say I have a favorite because there's much, much more that I need to be seeing.
Yeah. Well, that sounds fantastic. I can't wait for that book, Phil. In fact, it's kind of funny, and we'll go with this, but I was asked to put together a montage for an Easter service a few years ago, a filmic montage of for a big community Good Friday Passion, service, and basically edited together from all these different Jesus films, the different takes on the Passion of Christ, death and everything, and resurrection for like these Good Friday Easter services. It was like, might have been about 2 minutes, but we just cut together, and so it was really interesting to see all the different takes on it, you know.
Well, I'll be back in 2 years when the new book is ready.
Okay, Phil. Well, thank you so much. It's been so interesting, and keep up the good work, and maybe we'll work together since we're both also, you act in films and do a lot of other things.
Oh, yeah.
And actually being in films, who knows, maybe we'll work together on something.
Send me a script. I'll be glad to be in your new movie.
Okay, thank you, Phil.
Okay.
Hopefully this one's a success that's coming out, and I'll get to make another one, and maybe we'll work together sometime.
Super.
Well, thanks again, Phil, and God bless you, and thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. And I wanted to mention tomorrow I'll be in the other chair. I'm going to be the guest tomorrow because of the controversy over my new film, Canaan Land. A great movie producer, Al Doshna, is going to be guest hosting and interviewing me. I'll be being the interviewee and not the interviewer about why did I make Canaan Land? Why do I want to make it? What is my passion for making this film? And we'll deal with some of the controversies about that. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And tune in tomorrow at a special time. Richard Rossi, I'll be the guest tomorrow. And it'll be at 2 p.m. Pacific time.